The Japs never became blind adherents of the Indian-born and Chinese-transmitted customs. They used what was applicable to their own needs and rejected the rest. The ultimate aim of medieval Zen was to create keen, determined men with crisp, clear mentalities who would be calmly active and skillfully concentrated in all their undertakings, who would spontaneously sink self in the service of their country. The dull lethargy, spectral melancholy and anti-worldliness of many Indian monks did not suit such a virile, optimistic and practical race. The students were not allowed to pass the day in lazy, futile or parasitical existence, but were given active duties to keep them busy. The Zen aim being a balanced existence, they were made to work hard and to meditate well. But at the end of the disciplinary period, with the exception of those who felt an inborn and overwhelming vocation for monkish retreat, they were sent back to worldly life to marry, take up a career and make good. Equipped with the power of instant and sustained concentration, poised to meet the difficulties and vicissitudes of practical living with undisturbed equanimity, universally respected for their high character, they generally forged ahead of other men and became highly successful in their chosen careers. Many of Japan's most famous beyond yoga soldiers, statesmen, artists and scholars were Zen-trained men. Their ideal was a perfect balance of the inner and outer man, with efficiency as the keynote of both. The quality of their meditation was so high that a half hour daily was sufficient after their departure from the monastery to keep them in contact with spiritual peace. Thus their worldly life did not suffer but was enriched. There appeared to be little room for such an arrangement in modern life, so meanwhile we had to look at the facts as they were today. Waiting for wisdom. Such were the unpalatable conclusions which I drew after my Western and Indian courses of experience in yoga, as I then knew it, both of which brought me to the point of intense inward abstraction but no farther. It will be apparent that my concern was not merely personal alone, but to some extent altruistic. I had devoutly hoped to find in mysticism a system that could completely satisfy the higher aspirations of all those who, like myself, mad have experienced the final test. I had once thought that the contemporary materialism might find its partial cure in mysticism. Such perceptions came to me only after I had made the initial mistake of believing and occasionally supporting all the traditional claims on behalf of yoga exercises which one had heard. It was only later and with great difficulty that the growing breadth of my approach enabled me to separate what was sound from what was superstitious in these claims. Thiel's words might easily be misunderstood. Mental quiet has been strongly advocated in my books and I do not regret or retract such advocacy for a single moment. The infiltration of a little peace into a busy life is relatively of great value, and even the memory of a morning's half hour bathed in blessed tranquility sweetens the harshest labor and disciplines even degraded pleasures. I have frequently stated in my books that it was never my purpose to induce Westerners to flee into ashrams but only to flee for a / hash into themselves. Those books show such a way, the practice of their exercises offers such an abundant reward, and the latter may well be enough for most people. The other benefits of meditation, if correctly practiced, which is not often, also constitute a valuable asset, possessing a practical bearing on life and conduct. They are chiefly, the ability to concentrate thought at will, greater pacification of emotion and passion, greater power to keep undesirable or troubling factors out of the mind, and finally a better understanding of oneself. Such benefits are obviously not to be despised and are most useful. Even amid the ordinary avocations of daily living, from my personal knowledge several well-known and active men of affairs, such as Lord Kitchener, the late British Field Marshal, and Lord Brabourne, the late Governor of Bengal, had been privately interested in these practices. But for the few, again like myself, who sought to understand the meaning of life and to unravel the imperious problem of truth, peace or self-discipline could not alone still forever the keen hunger of the mind, however valuable in themselves. In short, I sought the realization of those promises of ultimate knowledge which the old Sanskrit books held out as pertaining to the higher mysteries of yoga. I ought to pause upon this parenthesis to render clearer what I mean by the words higher mysteries of yoga. They represent the difference between knowing something and feeling it. In the depths of meditation one felt, apart from transitory emotional exaltations, the world to be like a passing dream, the body to be but a drag on one's true self, and the only permanent value to lie in the heart's ineffable depth. Through long practical tests I had plumbed the depths of yoga, as the mystics and yogis of my acquaintance seemed to know it, and found the proper limits of its usefulness. It certainly gave much, it gave the misty feeling of having reached truth, but it did not give the irrefutable knowledge of truth. Yoga gave only these vague feelings but could not turn them into definite formulation. Moreover, it could only convert these intermittent experiences into permanent attitudes if one were willing to abide in meditation the day long. This was not only impracticable to most men but also, I know now, impossible to all men. My bafflement had been intense until the notion slowly dawned on me that such permanence could arise only out of the balance between knowledge and feeling. When intellect had discovered what emotion glimpsed, when it had established that discovery upon an irrefutable basis of fact forever proved, and when reason and feeling had perfectly fused into spontaneous action, the whole being of a man would be harmonized, his outlook firmly established and his inner peace welded like steel into an unbroken and unbreakable element. It would then no longer matter whether he were active in the noisy world or plunged in silent trance, for his life would be an integral unit. There were statements in the old Indian texts which supported these notions. Although such understanding of the inmost nature of the world, such insight into the subtler meanings of life, could come into real rather than theoretical existence only so FDR as it was of oneness own making, it was equally true that some ancient finger beyond yoga had to emerge out of the darkness and point out the way which led to it. Thus the knowledge that there were apparently summits still unclimbed, and that no paths leading to them were nowadays discernible, filled me at times with aching discontent. This need of wider intellectual enlightenment concerning both the nature of the world and its correct relation to the mystical view of man, in short, truth in all its fullness, caused me to look around and consider where else it might be satisfied. I knew several of the answers of the West, knew too that they were often excellent as far as they went, but they did not go far enough. Science frankly confessed its own insufficiency, and the foremost scientists like Jeans, Eddington and Planck had begun in sheer compulsion to point their venturesome fingers towards philosophy. I knew something of the Western philosophies, admirably reasoned and laboriously worked out as they were, but their tremendous conflict of opinion largely cancelled out each other's value and left the student bewildered. I knew, however, that the foremost thinkers of Asiatic countries had leisurely pondered this problem long before the first city Greeks had begun to ponder it in Europe. Moreover, there was this vital difference, that whereas the Western thinkers usually claimed that nobody had discovered ultimate truth and that human limitations were so narrow that nobody was likely to discover it, the authors of old Asiatic books claimed that ultimate truth was certainly discoverable and that a few sages had definitely known it. I remembered the enthusiasm with which, in my younger days, I had hotly advocated this claim to a skeptical French artist as we walked beside the Seine on moonlit nights. But alas, in those days I had used the words sage and mystic as interchangeable, now am I knew a little better. I felt therefore that if help lay anywhere it lay in Asia, the continent where the world's most renowned religious, mystic and philosophic teachers from Jesus to Confucius had been born. It needed but slightly more consideration to narrow the search to India because I knew from wide study and personal travel that all the Asiatic lands, like Tibet, China and Japan, had directly or indirectly derived their philosophic knowledge, yoga systems and religious speculations from this single fountainhead. The stream of philosophic thought was likely to be purer at the source, and so I examined its position in present-day India. At first sight it was evident to any man whose brains were not closely packed with dusty cobwebs that the medley of contradictory opinion and barrenness of useful result which afflicted Western philosophy was just as prevalent in India, too. There were six classical systems which claimed to explain the universe rationally, but each started from totally different premises and appealed to totally different facts. Consequently, they all arrived at irreconcilable notions of what constituted the truth. There were also innumerable theological and scholastic systems which masqueraded as philosophies, hiding their ultimate appeal to faith by an immediate appeal to reason, or priding themselves on their magnificent structure of reasoning whilst beginning with the biggest of all dogmas, that of the existence of a personal God. There were not a few seers and saints upon whose heads the populace had thrown a nimbus of holiness, who claimed to be on intimate terms with the Supreme Creator and who explained verbosely what the significance of the universe was according to the explanations which the Creator had personally vouchsafed to them. Here again there was so much conflicting doctrine that one could only decide that the divine plan was changed from month to month according to the Creator's momentary mood. There were also numerous would-be authors who offered the maximum of verbiage with the minimum of meaning. Wherever one went in this talkative country, agile-minded teachers could be found who performed breathtaking feats of logical legerdemain and who were willing to pour out on the least provocation a profuse spate of lengthy words, often meaningless, sometimes cryptic and generally combining to form unproven or unprovable statements. But what experience in this world meant was finally as elusive as ever. I wanted a philosophy devoid of dogma whose truth could be proved as irrefutably as one could prove an experiment in science, in short, to walk on sure ground. Most other men in my position would undoubtedly have remained content with their yogic acquirements and enjoyed the daily peace of meditation, retreating to the inner self and leaving intellectual busybodies to worry over the meaning of the universe. Unfortunately, my temperament was differently constructed. The stars of cold reason and quixotic strangeness were in conjunction at my birth. I had had sufficiently ripe experience of society and its appalling aridity to know how transitory and how defective were the external satisfactions it offered in comparison with inner achievements. Great poverty had dragged itself on miserable crutches towards me when the fullness of a rich existence was my aim, and I had loathed it. Great wealth came fawning to my feet at a time when the simplest of lives was my ideal, and I had spurned it. Now I disregarded both because my personal life had been committed to higher hands and I could take whatever came to me with contentment. Beyond yoga. I had reached a mature age when the first grey hairs had grown alarmingly and the mind had grown sufficiently to make me feel that any attempt to evade its insistent questions would do violence to the integrity of conscience. I had been thrown by time into an epoch tremulous with fateful consequences, when the whole world was being dazed and stunned by a devastating series of startling experiences and caught in a complicated web of events from which it would emerge either ruined or rejuvenated. It was an epoch which had tried to equip itself as a candidate for death. Because I belonged to the ink-stained fraternity, I was naturally interested in the fate of my fellow dwellers on this sad star. The aspiration to serve the minority of earnest seekers among suffering ignorant humanity with a compassionate offering of truth, however humble and imperfect, as I had earlier tried to serve them with an offering of peace, burned like a consuming fire within me. There were not many years left for an overworked body and I could not afford to wait supinely for the grave whilst these questions remained unanswered. But I was caught in a mental cul-de-sac, from which there seemed no way to emerge until I remembered that if there was no one in India's living present to help me, there might yet have been someone in her dead past. Her most serious reflections on the meaning of existence lay entombed in a multitude of oblong yellowing palm leaf manuscripts. Perhaps among those muted voices it might be possible to find one or two which could speak sympathetically and understanding to me across the centuries. So I decided to search for such an author's work. See Chapter 2. Trust you will place before the Congress the goal of the truth of Indian philosophy, the attainment of the happiness of all beings, as enshrined in the great Sanskrit sayings, Savjana Sukhino Bhavantu, may all humanity be happy, and Savsattva Sukho Hita, which brings about the welfare of all that exists. Telegraphic message from His Highness the late Maharaja of Mysore to the Indian delegate to the International Philosophical Congress, Paris, 1937. OIIT not with a disputer about fate nor begin a conversation with him was the wise admonishment of the practically minded Prophet Muhammad, who thus dismissed the question at a single stroke and doubtless saved much time and endless speech for his trusting followers. Certainly someone like fate, who had not seldom befriended me in the past when I invited her attention by determined effort, now appeared and took a sudden hand in this celestial game. I grope on the darkening shelves of memory for the book of this incident. I had gone high up into jungle-covered hills to escape from the society of my kind for a time and to work at shaping a medley of research notes which had accumulated around me. The needs of a hypersensitive temperament rendered imperative such a withdrawal from society at recurring intervals. Formerly I had cherished the hope that in the supposedly spiritual society of a certain ashram, the Indian equivalent of a fraternal hermitage or monastic institution, I might find the harmony of lofty thought and peaceful conduct which would suit those periods of escape from worldly activity. The hope finally turned out to be a laughable illusion, whilst the ashram turned out to be a miniature fragment of the imperfect world I had deserted. To those who feel the same inner need, I would therefore strongly recommend through experiment and experience the only perfect environment which will fit their case. It is to return to Mother Earth's friendly scenic solitudes and to make her enchanting beauty their mistress, in shady silent forests or on lofty rugged heights, beside quiet flowing streams or unpeopled wave-beaten shores, in the earth's stillness, the sky's color and the mountain's purity. They will always find healing balm for the wounds caused by contacts with a harsh, unlovely world. The new perch which I had established through the generous hospitality of His Late Highness the Maharaja of Mysore was one such blessed spot. As one's eyes travelled the whole circle of this inviting and inspiring Southwest Indian horizon, no village came into view, no city stretched out its cruel tentacles like a giant octopus to seize the green countryside. Nature was my companion, her wild solitary grandeur was my joy. In her beautiful presence, under expectant beech bloom dawns and hushed coppery red sunsets, I knew that I would soon recover what I had lost among petty-minded men as well as accomplish a modicum of pressing work. 3 inspired weeks passed by when there suddenly befell an unlooked-for event. My servant appeared one afternoon and handed me a letter which had been given him by a stranger. It was nothing more than a simple request for a few minutes' chat from an Indian gentleman who wrote that he was familiar with my books, and having come into the neighborhood on a vacation had discovered that I was there. Yet, had I but known it, on this slip of grayish-white paper was inscribed the next phase of my tortuous destiny. I could not help being amused at this unexpected visit, for I thought that I had well and truly secured solitude in this obscure place. I savored something of the surprise which filled the mind of a famous missionary explorer long lost in the jungles of Central Africa, who was suddenly confronted by the figure of a white man appearing as if from nowhere. The latter politely raised his hat and said, "Mr. Livingston, I presume." Presently the writer appeared, a white-turbaned, bespectacled old Brahmin gentleman of placid countenance and short stature, with 3 small books tucked under his arm. It is a fact that within 10 minutes I was listening eagerly to him, the while he talked vigorously of the very problem which had so troubled my mind. Thus the serpentine coil of fate began to unfold again in a curious but momentous manner. Soon he was turning the pages of one of his books, the famous classic Bhagavad Gita, and expounding quotation after quotation in ardent advocacy of his unconventional theses, which were, that the orthodox view of yoga was generally inaccurate and certainly insufficient, that the practice of meditation was an excellent mental preparation for the quest of truth but by itself could never yield truth, that 99% of Indian yogis practiced preparatory disciplines under the widespread but mistaken notion that all of them led directly to the same highest goal, and that hardly any contemporary yogi knew or followed the only path which could bring a man to the realization of ultimate truth, which was called the yoga of philosophical discernment and whose culminating stage was the yoga of the uncontradictable. He picked up from the table the second of the volumes which he had brought and said, "Permit me to introduce a book which is scarcely known, much neglected and rarely read because its contents are either beyond the comprehension of ordinary students or obnoxious to the preconceived notions of ordinary pundits. It is called Ashtavakrasamhita. It is not less than 3,000 years old and may even be many thousand years older, for our remote forefathers did not burden themselves with keeping dates. This is the mysterious book which Bengal's much revered sage and yogi of more than a half century ago, Sri Ramakrishna, used to hide under his pillow and produce only when he was alone with his most developed and favorite disciple, the famous Swami Vivekananda. None of his other followers was ever instructed in its lofty doctrines, for it would have upset their most cherished beliefs. From this you will perceive that this is not a book for beginners. It describes the highly advanced teaching given by the sage Ashtavakra, who had personally realized the ultimate goal of Indian wisdom, to King Janaka, who was an ardent seeker after truth, yet remained faithful to his practical duties as the ruler of a nation. Its later chapters emphasized the fact that the true sage does not flee to caves or sit idly in ashrams but is constantly engaged in work for the welfare of others. It points out that he will even outwardly pretend to be just like ordinary people in order not to be put on a pedestal by them. But the tenet to which I particularly wish to draw your attention is condensed in verse 15 of the first chapter. This is your bondage, that you practice meditation. The meaning here is that meditation constitutes a practice for developing calmness, abstract subtlety and concentrative sharpness of the mind, and that the earnest seeker must not be so captivated by its resultant peace as to tarry at this disciplinary stage, but should complement it by seeking the higher truth. Ashtavakra warns his royal disciple not to rest content with mysticism, ordinary yoga or religion alone, but also to take the further step necessary to acquire a knowledge of the philosophy of truth. That step is contained in a higher system, called philosophical discernment, for which such power to tranquilize and concentrate thought as is given by ordinary yoga is certainly an essential but nevertheless only an attendant move. You will now understand why such revolutionary doctrines are not palatable to popular taste. The visitor put the book down, paused in his speech and looked at me through his large round spectacles. I felt a deepening interest in him. Assuring him of my warm interest, I begged him to proceed. He now tenderly handled the third book in his little collection, the while he produced and praised it so highly and then showed it to me. The volume consisted of a very brief text entitled Mandakya Upanishad, containing only 12 terse paragraphs, together with a long supplement entitled Gaudapada's Karika, containing 215 short paragraphs, and finally a lengthier commentary written by the renowned Shankara on both text and treatise. He who intellectually masters both texts and commentary thoroughly has mastered the highest statement of truth of which India has remained the unique custodian through thousands of years and fragments of which have been borrowed by the rest of Asia, remarked my visitor. This work contains the master key to those higher mysteries beyond yoga, of which you have heard and which you have sought, known as the yoga of philosophical discernment, which in its turn culminates in the ultimate approach called the yoga of the uncontradictable. These methods begin where meditation leaves off, for they are really philosophical disciplines using the intense concentration generated by yoga practice, and they are directed towards freeing the mind of its innate ignorance and habitual error. Hard indeed are they to comprehend for us of the East, but harder still for you of the West. These advanced yogas are ignored by almost our own Indian yogis and usually misunderstood by almost all our pundits. Yet knowing these neglected systems, you will need to know no others. If in India, the land of its birth, this text is so little cared for and less understood, how hopeless it is to look for correct penetration of its meaning among your Western Orientalists. Now among all the mainsprings of my variegated Indian travels, that which primarily drew me to visit Mysore in response to its ruler's generous call was the unique reputation enjoyed throughout India by His Highness the late Maharaja. His irreproachable character, sincere devotion to culture, and untiring effort for improving the welfare of his people during a long reign of more than 40 years had made him the most universally respected and widely beloved of all the native rulers. Footnote: The Secret Doctrine of the Sage Mandakya, and the Concise Stanzas of Gaudapada. Gandhi had admiringly acclaimed him with the unique title of Raja Rishi, that is, King Sage. When I came to know His Highness more intimately, I discovered that the secret source of all his greatness lay in the philosophy with which he had identified himself, and which I shall endeavor to explain in this book. From sea splashed Cape Comorin to the venerated Himalayas, he had traveled to meet the most renowned scholars and holy men of his land. From Kashmir to Benares, he had conversed with the leading pundits and yogis, and he had even crossed the snowy ranges into cold Tibet on a mystical quest. He sounded the depth of all these men. He was therefore better entitled than most Indians to judge what was of most worth in his country's culture. And this he finally found in the hidden philosophy, whose true interpretation he embodied not only in personal but also in public life. His late Highness summed up the practical value of what he had learnt in the message to the International Philosophic Congress quoted at the head of this chapter, the message that all humanity should be treated as one family. No loftier message nor a more valuable one could have been given to the world at such a bewildering time. No institutional religion or exoteric philosophy has yet really given it, because all religions and philosophies have, by the mere act of labeling themselves, hitherto excluded the followers of other faiths or other teachings from their folds. Europe did not heed this warning, not knowing that the concepts of genuine philosophy, far from being futile, contained actual implications for ethical guidance, and the worst war of its history broke out within 2 years. The two Sanskrit passages mentioned in this message were chanted daily in the Mysore Palace. His Highness proved in his own state that philosophy could be practically applied with outstanding benefit to the common people. Mysore well earned its familiar description of a model state, as well as its frequent mention of being the most progressive one in all India. His fame had spread far and wide, and at his death the Times, the leading London newspaper, eulogized him as having set the standard for the rest of India. Such was the practical fruit of true philosophy. Might also be permissible to mention here that the late Maharaji took a close personal interest in my philosophical and literary progress, and said to me some years before his death, "You have studied and carried yoga to the Western people, now study and carry the best that India has to give, our higher philosophy." The hour of fulfilling the second part of the duty which was then laid upon me has at least arrived. His Highness was so anxious for the vindication of truth that he warmly encouraged my labors on the present book, and it is my grief that he did not survive to witness its publication. The vanished sages declared from their Tower of Sapience the existence of an ultimate path which alone brought the questioning mind of man to rest in the perfect wisdom and hidden power, the ethical beauty and universal beneficence of ultimate realization. In that sublime consciousness, even amid the terrific tempo of modern life, everything and everyone was known to be non-different in essence from oneself, that indeed was to be sought for. I came to understand yoga better after such a long period of research. I came to separate the preliminary and intermediate from the advanced and little known stages for which that research had been really a preparation. The three grades of yoga. A brief bird's eye survey may now be made of the relation between this hidden doctrine, which claims to be the crown and fulfillment of yoga, and the more popular inferior yogas. This will necessitate the inclusion of a few anticipatory glimpses of material properly belonging to more advanced studies. This relation will come out more clearly if we divide the yoga praxis into three progressive degrees through which we rise into wider awareness. The most elementary group is devoted entirely to physical exercises in concentration, because these appeal more readily to those, always most numerous, whose intellects are uncultivated. The beginner in mathematics is likely to be much bewildered if he is started on his course of study by a presentation of the binomial theorem, which is therefore reserved for a later phase of his studies. Similarly, the novice in yoga who is temperamentally and educationally fit for nothing better is put on one or other of these physical exercises. But some of them possess a further aim than the cultivation of concentration, being intended to improve the health, increase the strength and help to heal the maladies of the aspirant. It is recognized that a sickly body disturbs the mind and chains thought to the ailment itself. Therefore, these exercises are not infrequently prescribed as a preliminary step even to those who are cultured enough to start in a higher degree. The methods employed sound strange to Western ears, but they are not without remarkable efficacy for their special purposes.